In the quiet college town of Crandall, Ohio, evil wears tweed and grades papers. Stephen King's Holly introduces us to a horror far more disturbing than supernatural monsters, the kind that might invite you in for tea. The year is 2020, and COVID-19 has emptied streets and isolated communities. Against this backdrop of collective fear, people are disappearing around Deerfield Park. A jogger vanishes during his morning run. A young woman named Bonnie Dahl never returns from a job interview. A black janitor stops showing up for work. Enter Holly Gibney, detective, anxiety sufferer, and reluctant hero. Recently bereaved by her manipulative mother's death, Holly takes on Bonnie's case when the desperate mother Penny Dahl appears at her agency's door. What begins as a missing persons investigation soon reveals a pattern of disappearances spanning decades, all connected to a stately Victorian home on Ridge Road where retired professors Rodney and Emily Harris maintain their respectable facade. What makes this story so chilling isn't just what the Harrises do in their basement, it's the mundane normality they maintain upstairs. They host Christmas parties, they mentor students, they discuss literature over dinner, and they believe, with absolute conviction, that consuming human flesh reverses aging and cures ailments. The most terrifying monster, King reminds us, isn't the one hiding under your bed, it's the one hiding in plain sight. Holly Gibney isn't your typical whiskey-drinking detective with a mysterious past. She's awkward, anxious, and struggles with OCD tendencies that intensified during the pandemic, turning her hand sanitizer use and social distancing into rigid rituals. These supposed weaknesses become investigative strengths. Her obsessive attention to detail helps her spot overlooked inconsistencies. Her social awkwardness heightens her awareness of behavioral cues. Her pattern recognition skills, developed to manage anxiety, prove crucial in connecting seemingly unrelated disappearances. Holly's relationship with her recently deceased mother forms the story's emotional core. Charlotte Gibney controlled Holly through manipulation, fabricating financial problems to maintain dependency. Discovering her $6 million inheritance, Holly channels her anger into action, smashing her mother's ceramic figurines and funding her investigation. This personal journey parallels the central mystery. As Holly uncovers her mother's deception, she simultaneously exposes the Harris's deadly secret. Both revelations show how those presenting as nurturers can harbor the darkest intentions. Deerfield Park sits at the heart of Crandall, like an artery pumping life through the community, yet has become the Harris's hunting ground for methodically selecting victims. The social geography creates perfect conditions for predation. Ridge Road curves from Bell College to the park with affluent professors' homes, while opposite lies Red Bank Avenue with its struggling businesses. This economic divide creates blind spots where disappearances are attributed to personal problems rather than foul play. The Harrises exploit these divisions with their disabled van ruse, pretending to need help with a wheelchair, targeting those traveling on foot or bicycle. Jorge Castro, Peter Steinman, Ellen Kraslow, and Bonnie Dahl all vanished, sharing one crucial trait: none owned cars. Their Victorian home provides perfect infrastructure, just far enough from neighbors to muffle screams, yet close enough to maintain respectability. When Holly maps the disappearances, she sees they form a circle around the park, a pattern invisible to authorities who treated each case as isolated, revealing how terrifying threats exist in everyday spaces. What makes the Harrises truly terrifying is their ordinary identity. Rodney, a retired life sciences professor with early dementia, and Emily, a former English professor with sciatica, maintain academic facades while harboring monstrous appetites. Their descent begins with desperation, believing human flesh, particularly liver, reverses aging and alleviates ailments. What starts as survival transforms into addiction. Emily initially participated for her husband, but soon believed in the miraculous effects herself. Their compartmentalization is chilling. They torture victims in their basement, then calmly grade papers upstairs. They prepare elf parfaits with human brain tissue and discuss human-based recipes with disturbing domesticity. Their age provides perfect cover. As FBI profiler Curtis Rogan notes, no one expects old people to be serial killers. Emily needs a cane, yet possesses the callousness to clean out a victim's trailer after killing her. The Harrises completely dehumanize their victims as mere livestock. King's most unsettling message? Monsters don't announce themselves. They grade papers and attend faculty meetings while harboring unimaginable darkness. King transforms statistics into people by vividly portraying each victim's life before their tragic end in the Harrises' basement. Jorge Castro, a health-conscious writing professor, stands in stark contrast to his cannibalistic captors. Carrie Dressler escapes an abusive home only to find brief community at a bowling alley before his abduction. 11-year-old Peter Steinman's kindness becomes his downfall when he helps a woman feigning disability. Ellen Kraslow, a black vegan janitor, chooses death over compromising her principles by refusing raw liver despite desperate thirst. Bonnie Ray Dahl, hired as a Christmas elf, displays cunning intelligence by negotiating for water while planning her escape. Through these portraits, King explores vulnerability and predation. The Harrises deliberately target those with minimal social connections whose disappearances might be attributed to personal troubles, ensuring readers feel the full weight of these calculated crimes. While Holly investigates disappearances, Barbara Robinson finds mentorship with poet Olivia Kingsbury, offering creative counterpoint to the novel's darkness. Barbara initially approaches Emily Harris for an introduction to Kingsbury. Unaware of Emily's true nature, she shares a poem about an inhuman creature. Emily offers hollow suggestions while privately harboring racist thoughts, a stark contrast to Olivia's authentic guidance. Barbara's sessions with Olivia become a sanctuary of genuine connection. They explore rhythm, artistic transcendence, and poetry's power to transform trauma into art. Olivia's advice to keep the channel open and the words flowing gains deeper meaning against the Harrises' predatory nature. Through Barbara's essay, King articulates his belief in art as life-affirming resistance. While evil cannot be eliminated, we can create meaning that transcends it. Poetry becomes metaphor for creation standing against the void the Harrises represent. The novel's climax shows Holly transforming from anxious detective to determined survivor. After discovering the Harrises' disability van with Wisconsin plates, she confronts them but falls victim to Emily's trap when she feigns a fall. Holly awakens in the basement cage that held previous victims. During interrogation, Emily reveals their true nature. There is no he, dear, only we. We eat them. When Rodney returns alone, Holly escapes through quick-thinking provoking his rage by calling his theories bullshit and highlighting his dementia symptoms. When he charges her cage, she grabs him and slashes his throat with Bonnie's triangular earring, revenge from beyond the grave. Though the Harrises are defeated, their evil lingers. Holly contemplates retirement, haunted by the idea that there's no end to evil. Yet when the office phone rings in the final scene, she answers, "Hello, this is Holly Gibney. How can I help?" This affirms her commitment to confronting darkness despite knowing it can never be eliminated, teaching us that courage isn't the absence of fear, but the determination to stand against evil anyway.